from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Talks began again yesterday in Vienna on the 12-year deadlock over Iran's nuclear program. Iran and the Six-Nation Negotiating Group have a November 24th deadline for an agreement that could conceivably, under the best of circumstances, lead to a comprehensive settlement and an easing of the present ongoing sanctions against the Islamic Republic. But many tough and thorny sticking points remain, and in this Forum segment, we want to turn our attention once again to the ongoing talks on Iran and its ongoing nuclear program. Joining us is Abbas Milani, who directs the Hamid and Christina Mogadam program in Iranian studies at Stanford. His latest book is The Shah, which we featured on Forum. And good to have you back here, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
We're also going to be joined, we hope, in the program by Shibli Tahami, who's an Anwar Sadat professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Let me begin, if I may, with you, Abbas Milani, and begin by just sort of nailing down, if we can, what this negotiation seems to be, at least at this point, shining the light on, so to speak. It seems to be centrifuges and what the breakout capacity is going to be and how quick the sanctions can move forward, and seems to be dickering back and forth about how much uranium enrichment capacity ought to be and how fast the sanctions can be lifted.
Yeah, I think the main points are no longer whether Iran will have centrifuges. There was, during the Bush administration, the U.S. policy that Iran should have none. Now it seems accepted that Iran will have some centrifuges. The key is how many. And the key is how many of them will be working. Because one, I think, option that is being negotiated is that Iran can keep about 20,000 centrifuges that it already has, but keep about only 2,000 of them churning. The rest of them have to be disconnected and under constant monitoring. Two is the amount of enriched uranium Iran can keep. That has to be negotiated, both enriched uranium at 5%, enriched uranium at 20%. Iran virtually has halved, more than halved, its 20% enriched uranium. Third sticking point is what to do with this heavy water reactor they have built in Iraq, whether they have to redesign it. And finally, how quickly the sanctions are lifted. I think these are the four, as you call them, bickering points. My sense is that a broad outline has already been reached. These minor points need to be ironed out.
Well, let me bring Shibli Tahami into this again. Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development, University of Maryland, and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. There are other sticking points, though, that seem to be under the surface here. Shibli Tahami, there is not only the ones that were so really effectively presented by Abbas Milani, but also there's concern about a parallel covert program in a disguised or underground facility. The IAEA has brought attention to the possibility of enhanced monitoring, and we've even been told in a November 7th report that there's suspicions of building an A-bomb. So a lot more figures into hammering out an agreement here than perhaps even the 5 points that we heard from Professor Milani.
Yeah, I'm sorry I came in a little bit late on it, so I didn't hear the entire thing that Professor Milani outlined, but I heard part of it, and one part that I didn't hear, also in addition to what you just said, is the duration of the agreement, because obviously one of the things that, there's a whole debate about whether the agreement should be last 20 years, 5 years, 7 years. That's a major sticking point, because I think it's going to be a timed agreement, in large part because the Iranians in principle want to have the right to enrich. It's a question, the limitations they want to see as a pragmatic, time-limited agreement. And obviously the timing will matter. But the clandestine issue is huge, of course. I mean, and I think given that there is not much trust, it's hard to know how you can verify it. There would need to be more intrusions. That's what I think is part of the plan, certainly that the U.S. is proposing. But in the end, you know, we've seen this before. Regardless of how many intrusions you have, if a state is going to try to do something clandestinely, it probably could. And I think that's an issue that makes a lot of countries insecure. Obviously, it's an issue that the Israelis raise all the time, in large part because they don't have any trust that Iran would meet its commitments. The Saudis and the Arab states who are kind of worried about an agreement, are really less worried about the nuclear issue directly as the Israelis are and the West is, and more about the political empowerment of Iran and the role it might then play in regional issues. So I think, you know, in the end, the focus in the short term is on those more technical issues of the agreement. But there will be, of course, the political questions that everybody's going to have to deal with, both here and in Iran.
Yeah, I like what somebody in the BBC said. This is a Rubik's Cube of technical and political issues to solve. We also get into, you mentioned Israel and Saudi Arabia, and there is a lot, and the Gulf states, which have a good deal at stake here if an agreement is made. But also, what I'm reading, the toughest line in terms of negotiations is not coming from the United States, but France.
Well, yes, France has extensive ties with Saudi Arabia. France has very close ties with Israel. And both of those countries are very much worried about any deal, particularly about a deal that they think allows Iran to keep a substantial amount of enrichment. Saudi Arabia just announced in the last, I think, 2 days that if Iran is allowed to keep enrichment activities going, they will immediately set up enrichment activities of their own, which might open the door for United Arab Emirates to do so. It might be sort of an enrichment arms race in the region. And what doesn't help with the negotiation is that just this week, Ayatollah Khamenei issued a 9-point declaration on how to destroy the state of Israel. If there was one time where he should have kept these opinions to himself, it was this week, because that 9-point, which virtually calls for militarizing the entire Palestinian Authority, all the occupied lands, aside from Gaza, is exactly what someone like Netanyahu needs to tell the world that the purpose of this program is ultimately the destruction of the state of Israel. Yet Khamenei also desperately needs a deal so that the sanctions are lifted, because the economy is in a tailspin with the falling price of dollar. It's going to be even more to keep the lights on in the country. So he is playing a very dangerous game of keeping many balls in the air, and all of them might fall. And unfortunately, when they fall on the head of the Iranian people and on the head of the Arabs in the region, and these foolish leaders don't end up paying any price.
Well, Khamenei is the supreme leader. Ultimately, if there's going to be any deal, it's going to be up to him. Prime Minister Zarif has put out a statement that the West is making excessive demands, and it makes me wonder, Shibli Tahami, if we're going to see the possibility of any kind of completion of a deal by Monday night, and if not, what does that mean?
You know, I was speaking to a high-level U.S. official on Sunday who's involved in these negotiations, and obviously he was very guarded, because he was worried that the Iranians may be underestimating the U.S. Need for a strong agreement, and they may be reading the political environment of a weakened Obama administration, the preoccupation with ISIS, and the election of a Republican Congress coming in January, all as a moment of desperation for Obama, and obviously the administration doesn't feel that way. They feel they can hold firm. So I think the prospects obviously are there. They're both sides in a way need it, and as Professor Milani pointed out, despite the Iranian statements, they really badly need this agreement, because they stand to lose big if there's no agreement. Still, the gap remains wide, and that's obvious, and I think we've all the reports that we have are that it's possible to have an agreement, but it's possible also that they will not declare failure, but have some kind of interim agreement or postpone the negotiations beyond the deadline, which is certainly a possibility. But that makes it very difficult for the administration. You mentioned the French opposition as being strongest. True. But, you know, I think we're underestimating how much opposition there is here in the U.S. And part of it is...
Well, forgive me, we've got hardliners on both sides, which have to be taken into account here, not only here, but in Iran. Now you've got a Congress which is much more opposed to probably any kind of amity toward Iran or any kind of thing that will work toward...
Undoubtedly. And I was last week I was speaking with a congressional Democratic Party leader on this, and he says, if the Obama administration thinks that The ISIS issue has meant that Congress is going to be far more receptive on an Iranian deal. They don't really understand the congressional dynamics even before the Republican Congress takes over in January. And I think the American public, interestingly for the administration, is actually less worried about Iran right now because of ISIS. In fact, I'm in the middle of a public opinion poll. The preliminary results show that 70% of Americans think ISIS is the biggest threat in the Middle East, and only about 11% think Iran is the biggest threat. So the ISIS issue has actually, in some ways, muted the fear of Iran, at least at the public level. But you know that when everybody's waiting to see what the administration will do. And no matter how good the agreement is going to be, it's going to be a compromise agreement. And this administration is going to have a tough time selling it. And obviously it's going to be even much harder if it is an agreement that doesn't meet the minimum in the conventional wisdom that people are expecting at this time. So they're really up against a tough bind. But on the other hand, if they fail, it's going to be even worse for them because you're going to be on a very dangerous path toward confrontation that no one wants to enter, particularly given the fight on ISIS. And the administration wants to pretend that there's no linkage between ISIS and Iran, and there isn't in the negotiations, but it's in the background. The ISIS issue changes the dynamics in terms of cooperating or not cooperating with Iran in the Middle East.
I'm going to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. We're talking about the last leg of nuclear talks aimed at reaching a deal over the Iranian nuclear program. And, of course, what one continues to hear from Iran is there are peaceful purposes behind this nuclear program. They are still denying the desire to build nuclear weapons. But if you'd like to join this conversation, you are invited to do so now. Our toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, your thoughts, and what you'd like to add to this conversation, any questions you might have. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. A listener writes, many leaked reports indicate that the main issue now is not the breakout capability of Iran. Iran has already agreed to shipping out the 5% stockpile to Russia. The main issue is a removal of UNSC sanctions. So, Abbas Milani, well, actually, not only the West that has to be dealt with here, it's also the EU and the UN, and we're talking about a whole range of sanctions.
Well, first of all, I don't think the person who wrote this is correct. The question is not the 5%. There is more or less agreement that Iran can keep much of its 5%. The question is the 20%, because as I'm sure your listeners by now know, the problem is 90% enriched uranium, which is easily convertible to weapons grade. And the closer you are to 90%, the closer you are to a breakout capacity. Iran now has oxidized virtually half of its 20%. They seem to have agreed to ship the rest of it out to Russia, although one Iranian official has denied this. But I want to just say one other point on ISIS, which I think is a very important point to remember. Everyone talks about how ISIS is impacting the urgency for the Obama administration to reach an agreement. But Iran is equally, at least, desperate to find a common ground to fight ISIS, although they say to the contrary. But remember, ISIS is primarily a radical Sunni sect bent on killing Shiites. They don't even accept Iranian Shiites.
Forgive me, this is exactly what they were doing under Zarqawi, and it's exactly what they're doing in Syria and Iraq. They are killing Shiites.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of their motto. They don't even call Shiites Muslims. They don't even call Shiites Iranians. They call Shiites the Safavid, which is the sect that forced Shiism on Iran, made Shiism the state religion in Iran. So Iran, that sees a third of its ally country, Syria, a third of its allied country, Iraq, now under ISIS control, and reads ISIS literature that says our real goal is killing Shiites, they too are desperate for these air attacks on Shiites, on ISIS sites.
Well, let's face it, aren't they at this point, isn't it safe to say that Iran is in this fight? It's in this fight in Syria against ISIS. It's certainly concerned and bringing Hezbollah warriors into the fray as well.
Iranian literature, and they're not only in it, they're the only force that has stopped ISIS. If you really read the Iranian literature, particularly in the last 2 weeks, their narrative is that the only reason ISIS has been stopped isn't because of the air attacks, it's because the commander of the Quds Brigades, Iran's special forces division of the IRGC, has personally went with the help of 70 of his comrades and pushed back ISIS, which is, in my view, nonsense. But they openly admit to being in the war in Iraq. They openly admit in being in the war in Syria. They have openly supported sending Hezbollah, which is a proxy of Iran, into Syria. So you're absolutely right. They're fully involved in this war, and very, very worried about where ISIS might next turn its attention to.
Again, Abbas Milani is director of the Hamid and Christina Mogadam Program in Iranian Studies at Stanford and author of The Shah. And Shibli Tahami is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development, University of Maryland, senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We have to get to our callers, Shibli Tahami, but let me get some response to you from you. This is a question that doesn't normally come up, but here it is in front of me on our website. Sean writing, why shouldn't Iran get nuclear weapons? And it reminded me, it's not a question necessarily to take for granted when you think about all the countries that do have nuclear weapons, including Israel, but it reminded me of an article that you did back in 2012, the New York Times, memorable in my mind, where you were advocating working toward a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East?
Undoubtedly. And I think, you know, actually, in some ways, even people who don't like Iran in the Arab world have generally said, let them have it, just because why are the double standards? Why are you singling out Muslim countries? There is that kind of tension in the public attitudes in the Middle East beyond Iran, including people, as I said, who may not be supportive of Iranian foreign policy. But of course, the principal issue here is Iran is obligated to meet agreements it had made with the international community in the context of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it would seem to have violated that. And so these demands are really being made with specific attention to that agreement. But let's face it, it goes beyond that. There's a world political order. The Western nations in particular are particularly worried about it and the consequences of Iranian power. And yes, in some ways, there is a bit of singling out even beyond that agreement. I think it has political connotation. It has to do something with distribution of power globally. But I want to go back just, if you allow me for a minute, to what Abbas said earlier, which is accurate, which is that, you know, both the U.S. and Iran have an incentive to defeat ISIS. Obviously, that's one reason why people thought this might be an opportunity for them to cooperate. I want to say that even outside the U.S. per se, I was in Abu Dhabi just last month for a conference, and it brought Iranians and GCC states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, people who normally are very worried about Iran and have had tension with Iran, particularly in Iraq and Syria, obviously been on the opposite sides of the issue. But ISIS is frightening to them as well, because even though they're Sunni, they're going against the Sunni establishment. They're going against the rulers. And you can see in the conversation, in fact, I tweeted from the conference there, that based on the presentations by both Iranians and Arabs, they both see some possibility of common ground over the ISIS issue, but mistrust remains so deep that they don't have an obvious path forward. And that's why I think what the U.S. and the international community does in agreement with Iran might help formulate a path that people can jump on.
Well, that's what a lot of people are hoping for, that it will diminish the threat of a new war in the Middle East, it will improve U.S.-Iran relations, and that will help stand up to ISIS. And after this 35-year freeze, a lot of people would welcome that, and they also feel it would also strengthen Rouhani and the pragmatists. But I want to get to our callers, and let me do that now, and we'll begin, Irwin, with you. Good morning. You're on the air on Forum.
Morning, Michael. Just wanted to comment that I think it's naive to think that every nation that isn't threatened is ultimately going to have atomic weapons, if not today, then tomorrow. And I think it's like asking them, well, do you really need an air force? And the answer is, well, we don't know, but better safe than sorry. I think that the conversation has to move beyond this onto what happens if and when nations do have atomic weapons, and what kind of a dialogue we can begin now to say, okay, this is how we have to deal with these situations. And I'm not sure where that goes, but I know that this is the time to begin those conversations.
Well, I thank you for the call. It gets back, if I go back to you, Shibli Tahami, on this, I mentioned that our proposal you had about a nuclear-free Middle East. But if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, then there's very little doubt in my mind that Saudi Arabia will seek one, Egypt will seek one, then you're going to have another arms race for nuclear weaponry, and this can't necessarily make the world feel safe.
Yeah, it might, although I think people who talk about it theoretically don't understand the complexity of those kind of decisions and how long it might take for them to start and get to where they want to go. Obviously, that's possible. I think that, you know, the conversation sometimes is unhelpful in large part because we talk about it in zero-sum terms. That is, as if we really had a militant way of stopping Iran from having nuclear weapons if we really wanted to, or stopping the Saudis, really, or stopping anyone in a way. You can minimize the chance, but ultimately, if we engage in confrontational policy, you know, the limits that we're going to impose on them are going to be compensated by their extra drive to want to get there. And so I'm not sure that there is really avoiding some conversation to find mutual interest, and the Iranians may decide that it's not in their interest in any case to have nuclear weapons. I'm not sure what benefit nuclear weapons would bring them. Frankly, they say they're not seeking nuclear weapons. Obviously, the international community doesn't trust them. But it's a conversation that's complicated. At some point, it has to be regional. But given the current regional environment, where you have violence and lack of leadership and disarray across the board, that's not going to happen anytime soon. So you have to focus on specific issues that you're facing at the moment.
Let me bring in another caller. And David, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, morning, Michael, and your guest. You know, back in the 1950s, there was a U.S. postage stamp called the Adams for Peace stamp, and the basic selling of nuclear power plants to America was based on the idea that down the block, this brand new nuclear power plant couldn't be used to make a bomb. America was sold on the idea that we could have safe electricity based on a nuclear power plant down the street. And this has never been resolved, because if you look at the whole discussion of what is being said about Iran, is that you can make a bomb with a nuclear power plant. So this is an unrequited lie that which side is true, and whether we should dismantle all the plants around the world, or whether or not we're going to trust another nation to build one of these suckers.
David, I certainly appreciate your call. This is a bigger subject for another day, but I thank you for it. Clearly, Iran, as we said, has been on the record saying they want nuclear energy and they want peaceful purposes of use of nuclear energy. But as we've been saying, not trusted, certainly by the six nations that are in the process of wrangling with them. Abbas Milani, I've got a listener here who sends an email. The listener's name is Hamid, and he writes, Abbas Milani is wrong about the efficacy of Iran in fighting ISIS. A Forbes article yesterday criticized the Obama administration for not recognizing that Iran and the Syrian army are the only potent forces fighting ISIS. Professor Milani's views seem to be tainted by his antagonism of the Iranian theocracy.
Well, I don't know how familiar the gentleman is with my views, but I certainly respect his right to declare them. The problem with ISIS and the problem with this listener is that they don't seem to take into consideration that both in Iraq and in Syria, while Iran and the United States have a common interest in fighting ISIS, they have diametrically opposed goals for both countries. Iran wants a Shiite-dominated Iraq, which is not going to work. Iran wants an Assad-dominated Syria, which is not going to last. The United States wants a different government in Syria, which Iran doesn't seem to accept. And the United States wants an all-inclusive government in Iraq, which Iran doesn't seem to favor. So clearly, whatever views they think I have hasn't tainted my recognition that while they have common enemy in ISIS, They don't have a common vision for the future of neither of these two countries. And when you don't have a common future for these two countries, it becomes very, very difficult to coordinate. And when you have a Republican Party in Washington, and when you have the radical wings of the IRGC in Iran, which as of this morning constantly harp on how the U.S. is the biggest enemy Iran has, and how Iran is the biggest enemy the U.S. faces, one in Tehran, one in Washington, then the notion that Iran is the most efficient form, or the murderous Syrian army, which has killed, helped kill, ISIS killed a lot of them, other radical Islamists who are in the region killed a lot of them. That's 9 million people who have been displaced. There are about 300,000 people that have been killed, at least partially because of the role of Assad, because of the support given to Assad by Hezbollah, by Iranian IRGC commanders, by Iranian IRGC advisors. These are all by the admission of the Iranian government itself. So the picture is a little murkier than what Mr. Hamid, in his optimism, seems to suggest.
Well, we only have seconds left here. I just want to get maybe some final thoughts, even perhaps prognostications, Shibli Tahami. We're going to see this brought to fruition on the November 24th date, or are we going to see essentially delay?
Well, you know, obviously I can't tell, and it's so close, it's hard to tell. You know, if I had to bet, it'll probably be on some kind of inter agreement with delay, but I'm hoping for more because I think it's going to get harder. I think if the administration, the Iranians, think now it's harder to make a compromise, trust me, it's going to be much harder come January.
Let us leave it there. I want to thank Shibli Tahami of University of Maryland, Abbas Milani of Stanford, and thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and another hour is up ahead. We're going to talk about sound in the hour ahead. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.